Welcome to the second installment of the Sedgwick Institute Live, where I profile influential thought leaders who make a difference and whose interests lie in the risk and insurance world. I'm Chris Mandel, Director of the Sedgwick Institute and Senior Vice President of Strategic Solutions at Sedgwick. And my guest today is Dr. Robert Hartwig, formerly President of the Insurance Information Institute and now co-director of University of South Carolina's Moore Center for Risk and Uncertainty, as well as a member of the faculty of the Moore School of Business. Earlier in his career, Dr. Hartwig held key positions with NCCI, Swiss Re, the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and other organizations. He has a PhD and a Master's of Science in Economics from the University of Illinois and holds the CPCU designation. He's a frequent industry speaker and has testified before Congress on numerous occasions regarding the state of the industry and related issues. Welcome, Bob.
Glad to be here, Chris. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. Thanks for taking the time for this. So let's start with the personal, Bob. Tell me a little bit about your family background and what you do when you're not crunching the numbers.
Well, I'm originally from rural New England out in central Massachusetts, and lived there really through college at the University of Massachusetts. And after that, went out to Illinois for graduate school, and that's actually where I met my wife, Laura, and we've been married 26 years. We have two kids. One's a 23-year-old Army lieutenant out of college, and the other one's a nursing student as a freshman in college. And I've kept them moving around a little bit, but the last 19 years or so was in New York with a couple of those organizations you mentioned, initially with Swiss Re, then actually back to NCCI for a little while, and then to the Insurance Information Institute 18 years ago, and I've never looked back. I've enjoyed almost 25-year career in the private sector and a little bit in the government sector in Washington, and now I'm here in academia, and that's always been a lifelong goal of mine. It's actually what I thought I was going to do when I was starting graduate school, and again, I took that 25-year detour. I've learned an awful lot, but it was just the right time in my career to make the switch to the academic world. It's very exciting to have the opportunity to help influence the next generation of insurance professionals.
Oh, very good. Very good. Well, it may have taken a while, but it sounds like you found your niche. Although, how did you choose the University of South Carolina?
Well, I had made the decision that this was going to be the year that I was going to leave, and I had always kept a foot in academia, guest lecturing, being a member of various academic associations, even on the board of directors of the American Risk and Insurance Association, and had quite a few contacts in the academic world, made it known to a few of them that I'd be looking the end of 2015. The academic market operates pretty differently from most other markets. Usually the interviewing goes on approximately 9 to 10 months before you actually start the job. So wound up with several really good offers, but USC, South Carolina, has one of the largest and highest ranked risk management insurance programs in the U.S. And I was also, having spent the better part of 25 years in Manhattan and Washington, was looking to sort of downsize in terms of the urban environment I was in, and was looking forward to shorter commutes, among other things. But principally, it was a really good fit here, and I'm able to spend about half my time teaching risk management and insurance, and the other half of my time I'll be teaching courses in corporate finance. So that satisfies the economist in me, while the insurance person in me enjoys the risk management and insurance teaching opportunities.
Sounds good. You know, it's funny, I interviewed Dr. Richard Victor, our senior fellow, last month as the first version of this, and his family profile and life profile and yours are very similar. Especially on the family side. But, of course, you're both economists as well. So there must be something about economists and the route they take in the world.
And I know. And both our kids went to Syracuse, too. So.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, funny coincidence.
Indeed, a small world. Mm-hmm. Well, let's turn now to who you are. Tell me about your life before III, and which you joined as an economist in 1998. What happened before that?
Well, that's right, and that's so long ago it's almost hard to remember now, but I was a 34-year-old when I joined the Insurance Information Institute in August of 1998 as economist, and I had come from the National Council on Compensation Insurance and in two stints there, with a stint at the Swiss Re in between. So I had at both NCCI and at the Swiss Re, I had I was in charge of various research functions, and particularly at NCCI, I was involved deeply in rate filings and cost of capital modeling, rate of return modeling, working hand in hand and side by side with actuaries on workers' compensation issues around the country. At Swiss Re, I was working primarily in the health insurance world and health reinsurance space, which was a new space for me, and it was also a learning opportunity. So I learned a lot from both of these positions. I had the opportunity, again, to do a lot of research, a lot of writing, testifying, public speaking, those sorts of things. And those were both very, very good training grounds for what would turn out to be the career that made me who I am. That was the time I spent as economist and then as president and economist of the Insurance Information Institute. So it was some fantastic learning experiences. Going to NCCI was the total immersion method of learning insurance. I didn't know anything about insurance. But I turns out, you know, I spoke the same language as an economist who was also principally a functioning as a statistician, and was able to quickly be conversant in the kind of the language of insurance, particularly with respect to actuaries and financial people. And then from there, broadened out, decided to get my CPCU so I could learn about areas besides just workers' compensation or reinsurance. And that turned out to be a really good move as well.
Very good. Well, you're an economist through and through. That's for sure, and you've got a very high profile in this industry. How did you achieve that visibility?
Well, you know, my craving for visibility, if you will, began even before I wound up in the private sector. Even as a graduate student at the University of Illinois, I had a research position where I would be investigating matters in the state economy and would write about them quite a bit. And would take on certain controversial issues such as utility rate regulation or military base closures, which was a big thing at that time, and doing my own little economic studies of all of these things. And as it turns out, when I published these studies, they wound up getting picked up widely. And even in graduate school, I was frequently, I was the only graduate student I knew who was regularly on television, radio, and the newspaper. Even the faculty weren't at the university, but I was on a wide range of issues. And I really liked that. And that was great media experience coming at a relatively young age. And I carried my desire to continue to do that forward. Didn't do so much as the government, but continued to do a lot of research. But by the time I got to the Insurance Information Institute, I had coupled that media experience with a lot of expert witness testimony experience that I had developed at the NCCI. And between the two of those, was able to develop a very strong public persona in terms of representing the industry, having a reputation for being very well prepared, well researched, and being able to listen to all the interests involved in the industry, represent those well in important fora, but at the same time, be respectful of the opinions of others, and to articulate in this work, articulate all of this both orally and in written terms. And that's you know, the ability to the development and the honing of analytical skills, and being able to use your communication skills to get those findings from your analytical persona across is an extremely important skill. And I think that's something that many people, they may have one skill or the other, but bringing those two together can make you a very, very persuasive person. And I think that was probably the secret to the success.
And it sounds like you honed that early on because, I mean, I don't know any graduate students that get that kind of exposure in the media. So you must have sought it out and clicked. Is that really what happened?
Oh, absolutely. I sought it out. I didn't shy away from, I deliberately sought out more controversial issues to write about. And I had the perfect position to do that and never shied away from these sorts of things. And I had a good mentor in terms of a professor I worked for who was fully behind all of these things. And it was the beginning of what I think would be a great career. I just didn't know it at that time. And it drove me down a path towards very applied economics, very applied statistics. And as it turned out, the sorts of things I was working on wound up being very good training ground for the sorts of things I would do later in life in the insurance world. Even when I first left graduate school and went to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission in Washington, my job title was statistician, and I was working on identifying emerging hazards for consumer products and the people who were being injured or killed using these very large real-time databases. And again, without knowing that, that was a fantastic training ground for what I would be doing in the world of insurance later on.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed you haven't lost any affinity for that. I saw one of your recent presentations where you were talking about the loss magnitude, I guess, particularly in the trucking industry.
Yeah, well, the insurance world to me is full of interesting, of an endless number of interesting issues, interesting data, interesting developments, and it's not just trends over time and sectors, say, like trucking. To me, I've been extremely interested in technology risks the past few years, and I think that when it comes to motivating new blood in the industry, and I'm in a perfect position to do that now. People don't want to just hear about what's in an HO3 homeowners insurance policy or what's in a private auto insurance policy. These are important, but what are you going to do to spark the interest of the next generation of insurance professionals, and even the current generation who might be in their silos for the last 10 or 15 years, but contribute in other areas where they have ability and interest. And I think it's important to think about the future of the industry, the risks of the future, and make sure that people begin to understand these, because this is really where the industry's bread is going to be buttered and money is going to be made. And lost in the decades ahead.
No, indeed. In fact, I so appreciate your insights to the cyber risk exposure that I saw in one of your recent presentations. Certainly a growing area of interest for many risk managers of the group I came from.
Absolutely, it is. Yeah, and that area is just one of several that's going to continue to mushroom over time. I really think we're just scratching the surface of this iceberg. And if we think we understand cyber risks now, we're deluding ourselves.
Well, for sure, it just morphs into something different so frequently, and you almost can't keep up with it. But I'm sure you'll be doing a lot of research in that area yourself. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because of your long time, I guess the majority of your career with III and NCCI, is the distinction between those organizations. I mean, I've been in this industry for more than 30 years, and honestly, I couldn't really tell you, without going and Googling it, what is the distinction between III and NCCI, particularly as it relates to their mission, purpose, and output. Can you give me a brief comment on that?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, they're really vastly different organizations, although I had a close working relationship with the NCCI the whole time I was at the Insurance Information Institute. But the NCCI is basically you can think about it as a rating bureau. In other words, it collects all sorts of information and data and statistics for workers' compensation and workers' comp only, and helps develop rates and advisory loss costs, has a few other functions as well, does a lot of research that sort of parallels and is in tandem with what WCRI does, though they don't step on each other's toes. And so basically, it's workers' compensation focused. essentially entirely. Now, workers' comp is a big line, and there are a lot of things to learn. It's a fairly complex line. But at the Insurance Information Institute, we are a trade association, and we represent the interests of the U.S. property casualty insurance and reinsurance industry in many different realms. But not including lobbying per se, and so the III basically will assemble and disseminate and analyze information across the vast spectrum of the insurance world. Again, focusing on property casualty insurance, and makes that information available to the general public, but also to the industry, legislators, regulators. Media, the academia, basically anyone who wants it. And the Institute is fully funded by the insurance industry, and we are always very upfront about that. The primary mission of the Institute is to help increase the understanding of insurance, what it is and how it works, but across the vast array of stakeholders that we have. And again, that ranges everywhere from the media, which is how many people are familiar with the Insurance Information Institute, or also in public fora, conferences, or company meetings that I or one of my colleagues might speak at. And then, the production of everything from original research to in-depth PowerPoints to our fact books and position papers on many topics. And so, again, it's a dissemination of information. And that mission has morphed over time, of course. It's not just about appearing in newspapers and magazines anymore. It's about bits and bytes and social media and websites and every other fora that is, that we're seeing here in the Internet age. I mean, when I started at the Institute, the websites were pretty rudimentary, and when I started at NCCI, I don't believe we had a website at all when I began there. And, developed it over time. The question is what to do with this thing? And over time, it's obviously NCCI's digital capabilities have become quite formidable, as have the Insurance Information Institute. So very different organizations.
Did you say III has a global audience?
Well, absolutely. The Institute's audience is certainly a global one. We would track on a monthly basis where hits for our website were coming from, for example. And as you might expect, predominantly the U.S., but other English-speaking countries like Canada and the U.K., but also increasingly places like India, places like China, South Africa, Malaysia, you name it, Indonesia, the Middle East, all over the world. But the Institute's membership, all of them write coverage in the United States, but many of them write coverage throughout the world. By that I mean primary or reinsurance coverage. So literally, companies from, I would talk from ACE to Zurich. I guess it's from AIG now to Zurich. Our members, and with major reinsurers, multinational insurers in between. So you can think about the Munich Re's and the Swiss Re's and the Lloyd's of London, but the large domestic insurers too, the State Farms and the Allstates, are all members of Farmers, all members of the Institute as well. So that the premium represented by the membership is approximately 2/3 of the premium written in the United States, and that's larger than any other association. And that's because we work with and support every segment of the industry, and we support their lobbying trade organizations as well, the AIA, PCI, NAMIC, RAA, and have very good symbiotic relationships with all of them. Again, we let them handle the lobbying, but we provide support for them and their members wherever and whenever we can.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you. Appreciate that. So you know better than anybody, and I want to talk a little bit about the future of the industry, but there's been a lot of talk about, the disruption that is going on, the disrupting influences that appear to be shaping the future of the industry. I'm interested in knowing, what's your view of the current state of the industry and this disruption that's emerging?
Well, this is an industry that has always been on the front line of disruptive technological change, and it's no different this time around here in the first part of the 21st century. Insurance is an old industry. You go back to the early days of Lloyd's, and if you just track that original marine business, you know that marine business has gone from sailing vessels to steamships to powered vessels, and many other things in between. And if you look at almost any dimension of the insurance world, we've had to confront technological changes and potentially disruptive forces time and time again. And the industry has persevered. From each new technological revolution, there arise myriad new risks. Some other risks go by the wayside. It used to be the case that insurers in the 19th century were insuring, delivery vehicles that were powered by horse and buggy. So now we don't worry about that very much anymore, but we do worry about everything, you know, that eventually gave way to trucks and trains, and that gave way to, ultimately, who knows, the next generation might be delivery by drones. But the industry has solutions for these sorts of things, and I think that far from an industry that's being kind of backwards and stuck in the old way of doing things, I really think that insurers are being very innovative at examining these potentially disruptive forces, providing insurance solutions where they are needed, being able to provide the limits of coverage where they are needed, and doing so in a way that in no way, shape, or form is impeding the technological process that is proceeding at a kind of a lightning pace. But again, that is a hallmark of the industry. We're talking about the rapid industrialization of America or other countries as they moved from an agrarian society to an industrialized society to the age of automobiles and aircraft and satellite communications. The industry has adapted well to all of these, and I have no doubt that that will happen this time around. I think there's a lot of discussion about the new types of technologies out there today somehow making insurance irrelevant or obsolete. I think that line of thinking is about as enlightened as the line of thinking that was espoused by people who many years ago thought that it would be a good idea to close the patent office because everything that was going to be invented already had. The reality of it is that there are risks out there today that are emerging or have yet to emerge that we can't even comprehend. I mean, to be honest with you, as we discussed earlier, when we think about cyber risks, if we think we understand that, we are deceiving ourselves. If we think we, and I'm not just necessarily talking about the malicious sorts of risks that come about from Russia or China or other bad actors. I'm talking about the risks that are going to arise organically from such things as the Internet of Things, where it has always been the case in history. You can go back to ancient times that while increased interaction between societies that allows societies to collaborate in terms of ideas, whether it's technology or whether it's on the social side of things or economic side of things, this has produced great advances in society. But at the same time, that is met commensurately with an increase in risk. And I expect there to be no difference this time around, unless all laws of economic history are believed to be suspended forever forward. And I just don't think that's the case.
It's funny, you know. It sounds like what you're saying is it's the exposure or the evolution of the exposure and the risk that's the biggest driver for that disruption. Even though you look at what, for example, Google's been up to, and part of it's process-driven, where they think they can do things more efficiently and from a transactional basis and the like. And I think back on my own buying days, if you will, as a head of enterprise risk management. And while insurance was certainly a core component of the strategy, the reality was then and is even more so now that so many of the risks that emerge from the evolution of business and exposures and the like are risks that really aren't insurable and really force risk managers and business leaders to find other solutions. How do you think about that? Not to, you know, downplay the importance of insurance.
Yeah. No, I'm in a position now where, when I'm talking about risk management to students, I talk about insurance as a component to that. And, again, using something like cyber risk as an example. Look, the same thing is true for aviation or marine insurance. People don't get on planes today because they're well insured. They get on them because they're safe. People go on cruises for 2 weeks in the South Pacific, not because of the fact that they believe that Carnival Cruise Lines is well insured, but because they believe the boat won't sink or crash into another ship. This is all about risk management. Insurance is there as a part of an enterprise risk management program. And this is the same as about cyber risk. People are going to go onto websites not because they believe that the company is insured in case someone hacks into their private information, but because they believe it's a secure site and that the site is otherwise useful to them. And so, again, nothing has fundamentally changed here. It's just that the nature of risks has changed. There is a something I'd like to study as an academic, and it would be what I might call a risk management advancement curve, if you will. The question is if we go back a century and look at aircraft, you were quite brave if you got onto an airplane. They crashed with great frequency, yet the insurance industry was willing to provide coverage beginning at about this point in time a century ago. For these relatively new machines that we didn't know how they would revolutionize the world the way that they have and how they would connect the world the way they have in many ways like the Internet is today. But we were intrepid. We provided coverage. And over time, risk management made travel around the globe by aircraft almost the safest means that you can imagine. So it was once the most dangerous means, and now it's about the safest means you can imagine. And I expect us to take that journey with the Internet and with the Internet of Things and many other technologies that are out there today, such as fracking technologies or working with biotechnology firms or medical science firms, firms doing research in genetics and various fields that you read about in the science pages of the New York Times. And if this is where smart insurers are today, is they're looking at the edges of insurability and where is that border of insurability, and can that envelope be pushed just a little bit further, not through some sort of naivete about what might happen, but by doing the research and doing the analysis and doing a little experimentation. And I think that those types of insurers are going to be the ones who ultimately succeed. And are there going to be some failures and setbacks? Of course there will be. There were any number of companies that lost a lot of money insuring airplanes and ships over the years. And there will be companies that lose money in insuring cyber risks and many of the other risks of the 21st century. But if done judiciously, it becomes a learning situation, not a disaster. And those companies, I think, will have the edge in terms of experience.
Yeah, well, in terms of the fundamentals of underwriting being based on predictability, it really is those pioneer companies that step in and agree to insure things that have little or no history to predict off of. And that's how, I guess, this whole discipline moves forward to some significant degree.
That's how it does. And this is also not just true for commercial insurers. This is true for auto insurers as well. I mean, I'm very glad to see that, for example, we see personal lines insurers, which are about half the business, quickly fill the voids that are needed by, say, people who want to be Uber drivers or people who want to rent out their properties using online platforms like Airbnb or most, other products that are not very technology-oriented but very popular now are things like food trucks, where you need a combination of various types of commercial and insurance coverage. Stepping into these voids very, very quickly, but in a way that is being done, you know, backed by solid analytics to the extent that there are data available, and learning by doing. Learning by doing is how technology firms do it. We have to mimic how they do it. And because if we don't do it, then someday somebody is going to eat our lunch. And we can't afford to have that insurance industry value chain completely usurped, which I think is one of the greatest dangers going forward. It isn't so much the new risks and whether or not they're insurable. It's the vulnerability of the industry's value chain.
Mm-hmm. Yep, couldn't agree more. So, speaking of the industry, what are your thoughts about merger and acquisition activity that appears recently to be escalating? What are the key drivers for that? And particularly, as I saw in one of your presentations, why the shift away from Europe?
Yeah, their M&A activity has it picked up last year, meaning 2015. It hasn't proceeded apace in 2016, and I think for a couple of reasons. The year started off in a very rocky fashion in terms of the stock markets. Terrible, terrible beginning to global stock markets, and usually stock equity is the currency that's used in many of these transactions. So the year got off to a very rocky start. It's also the case that, at least perhaps for the short term, many of the deals that could be done were done in 2015, 2014. So I think that's another reason why we've seen a little breather being taken here, with the exception of the healthcare space in the U.S., which is kind of a completely different animal. I think that in terms of shifting away from Europe, and there's been more of a trend towards North American and M&A involving Asian companies, we could take the most recent example. I think Brexit is probably a disruptive force that will probably have some limiting effect on European-style M&A activity, generally speaking. I think that the reason why we see more opportunities, more M&A activity involving U.S. firms is simply because this remains by far the largest market, and despite the fact that it's not growing all that rapidly, it still, in dollar terms, represents some of the greatest growth opportunities in the world. The fact is that the U.S. economy, for a number of reasons, it's growing faster than most of Europe. It's growing faster than Japan. It's not growing as fast as China, but nor is anybody else, but the market is just simply much, much larger. And then Asian companies are looking to diversify out of their home countries, out of their home bases. And if you look at Japanese insurers, they're looking at basically a perpetually stagnant marketplace with negative demographics, and a country that's been been stuck with deflation for many, many years. China's looking at a population implosion in the decades in the future, and Europe's not much better. So whether it's property casualty or life, I think North America looks like the place to go. I think that the economic prospects of places like Latin America will pick up over time, and other parts of Asia will pick up as well. If you want to make money, you got to go where the money is. And at the end of the day, the money to be made from the perspective of many is really here in the United States.
You know, you mentioned briefly the healthcare industry being a completely different animal in your answer. Just curious, I know you've been pretty heavily focused on P&C. Will your future work include the healthcare aspect of insurance?
Oh, yes. In fact, even here, I'm teaching already a course in life and health insurance, and I already have done some interviews down here in local media, for instance. What's very interesting is to watch what's happening with the Affordable Care Act, and the fact that in terms now of enrollments, in terms of participation by insurers, the act is falling well short of expectations. And right here in South Carolina, one of the very first interviews I did with local media here was the fact that Aetna decided to withdraw from the South Carolina Affordable Care Act exchanges, leaving only one company as an option here for the entire state. And so, you know, what does that mean? Is that a success story? Well, there may be access, but you have no options. Is that a success? Before, you might have had less access, but you had more options. So that's very interesting from an economic standpoint. And what does that mean in terms of where we're heading? And, you know, explaining these sorts of things to students, I think it's being able to talk about how the economics of these markets work and how certain fundamental rules of economics have been violated in the construction of the Affordable Care Act. And you cannot legislate away the laws of economics. If you have more sick people joining plans and pools than you have healthy people, you know, that's a problem called adverse selection, and it is a huge problem in insurance markets in general. But it's one that plagues health insurance markets, and it's one that's plaguing the Affordable Care Act. And it's exposing fatal flaws in its construction. And so it's good to be able to talk about these things with students, and I hope that some of them are bright and smart people who decide to, you know, make their careers in these areas and think hard about how we can create viable insurance marketplaces for the future.
Yes. Do I sense that maybe you would have been one that never really believed that you could keep your doctor and that you would save $2,500 a year in premiums?
I always remain fairly skeptical about that. I think that, you know, we had the opportunity to, in a relatively non-bureaucratic way, create at least some minimal level of access to affordable health care for the masses in the same way that we provide a level of education for every child in America, irrespective of their means. We provide certain minimum standards of living through various transfer programs, through various means. And these, by and large, while they have their warts, they're successful. And I think we had the opportunity to do that with healthcare reform, but the issue itself was so fraught with politics that I think it resulted in some you know, hidden fractures in the design of the law, which now are coming to the surface and are kind of causing the act to come apart at the seams a bit. And so it's going to be one of the top duties of the next president, whoever that might be, to fix the act, or as depending on what party you are in, you know, to repeal and replace. But nobody is talking about tossing the Affordable Care Act out completely. Even Republicans, we're talking about either repealing and replacing, and in the case of Democrats, you know, perhaps engaging in some sort of tweaking or at least maybe some minor surgery to try to restore the act back to its original intent.
Yeah, well said. Well, speaking of legislative change, I noticed in one of your presentations there was a slide in there from R Street about the grading of regulatory performance. Lots of D's and F's. What does that say about our regulatory system in your view?
Yeah, there are, believe it or not, that ranking with a lot of D's and F's, it's actually better than it was a number of years ago where there were more F's. But what it does say is that, because there's actually a fair number of A's and B's on the chart, and so it says that there's an enormous diversity in the quality of regulation of property casualty insurance out there today. And it's amazing, the diversity. I mean, a European or an Asian might look at this chart and think it's completely bizarre that there are, you know, 50 different regulatory schemes and that they could be so different from one another. You know, we have some systems that are overly politicized. In the United States, we have some systems that, for example, rely heavily on pretty archaic forms of regulation, such as prior approval of rates in areas such as auto and homeowners insurance and workers' compensation insurance, rather than some kind of, you know, use and file or file and use or perhaps no rate regulation at all in markets that are very competitive. And that's in part what results in the poor rankings for some of the states. Some states have engaged, such as in Florida, until very recently, in active rate suppression, and then have set up insurers to compete and reinsurers to compete with the private industry. Now, maybe some of those things are getting reversed, but I think that some of the low rankings are the harshest rankings are reserved for those states that have gotten in the way of commerce in a way that would actually benefit consumers. In most of these states where there are problems, you see actually that consumers have fewer choices. And it's hard to see how consumers are being in any way benefiting from the decisions that some of these states are making.
So that's the end of part one of my interview with Dr. Robert Hartwig. You'll find part two at a separate link on our website, and I urge you to go there and hear the rest of this very interesting dialogue. Enjoy.